Good morning, counsel, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm Judge Paul Harris. With me today are Judges Diane Bradfold and Luis Bjorkman. We have four cases on our calendar today. This is the second case. Counsel, just a couple of preliminary notes. This matter is being recorded, so I will ask that before each part of your argument that you please state your name for the record. In addition, there is a clock that should be visible on your screen. Mr. Seeger, can you see that clock?
Yes, I can, Your Honor.
Mr. Hagstrom, can you see the clock?
I cannot, Your Honor.
Okay.
Looking to where it is.
It should be one of the screens on the Zoom screen.
Should it be on where my screen is showing me?
Yeah, there should be on your screen, there should be other blocks that shows all of the other participants. If you are on your phone, you may have to swipe away from the video showing yourself to get to
Oh, I
the
can see
screen.
that, Your Honor. I can see it. And I see the
Righty.
clock.
All right. All right, with that, we are now calling court file A241973, Robert Gort versus Dennis Gort. With that, Mr. Hagstrom, you are the appellant. You can begin your argument when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm ready. Good morning, and I sincerely apologize for the confusion I've caused. But luckily, we made it. I drove up from Fergus Falls to be here, and your receptionist was quite accommodating to help get me onto this. This case actually started in 2015. I'm going to use just the respondent, Dennis Gert, because we have a whole collection of respondents in this matter. So when I refer to Dennis Gert, I'm referring to all of the defendants, except if I'm just specifying Dennis Gert. This matter started with a family dispute having to do with a trust that was commenced. Prepared by the respondent's father. And I can't remember the date of it, but it was back in prior to 2015. A dispute arose between the respondents, including Lucy Gert and Lucille Gert, rather. And there was some litigation started, but in the meantime, and before it ever got to a trial, the parties reached an agreement. And that agreement was that my client would give up an interest in the Section 4 land, which was the property belonging to his father and Lucille Gert, who was still alive at the time that this agreement was reached. The contract, it's a settlement agreement, but what it provided for, and at least the most important thing to my client, was an option to purchase under certain conditions and taking certain steps to exercise that option. One of the things that would trigger the exercise of his option or an opportunity to exercise the option was if Lucille received an offer to purchase the property from another person. That happened, and she provided a written notice, according to the settlement agreement, to my clients, the appellants here, and they notified that they wished to exercise their option at that point in time. At that point, the settlement agreement provided for certain steps to be taken. For example, agreeing on an appraiser or each party getting an appraiser to come up with a value on the property, and then they would go through the details of providing a closing date and such. That resulted in another lawsuit because the respondents never responded to the client's exercise, written exercise of the option to purchase. We went to court in Otter Tail County before Judge Senek, and we had a, I think it was a 3 or 4 day trial. And that was, let's see, the 3rd, 4th, 5th, 12th, and 16th of January. At the close of the testimony and the trial, Judge Senek came out with a decision in which he put everybody back to their original position. It's a little bit complicated, but he felt that his finding was that one of the steps that had to be taken were not taken by the respondents, and therefore the notice of intention to sell was inoperative at that point in time. So at that stage, my client, as part of the settlement agreement, was supposed to pick up or supposed to get some farm equipment that was there on the property. And that led to another dispute over whether the respondent in Dennis Gert primarily were taking effective steps that allow him to get his farm equipment there.
Counsel, if you don't mind, thank you so much for the summary of the proceedings, because this is a case, as you said, with a lot of history. And in fact, it's been in our court before. And we have reviewed the prior decisions of our court, as well as, you know, the really extensive briefing that you provided and the documents.
Yes.
And summary is very helpful.
Okay.
I'd like to, if we could, get forward to the current issue, which, as I understand it, doesn't partly involve this personal property issue that you mentioned, because ultimately that was what was tried to this district court, the issue that's now on appeal. And
as I
read your appellate brief, but I could be wrong, I didn't see that you're challenging the resolution of the personal property issue that was made in the latest decision. The one that's, is that right?
Your Honor, yes, Your Honor. And thank you for allowing me to cut right to the quick on this, because I didn't want to have to go through the whole history. Yes, the personal property was an issue to be determined at the trial, which was the last action, actually the last action that was left over after the summary judgments were ruled on. However, Dennis Gert was one of the witnesses, and what had happened is over that period of time, actually from the time that the Otter Tail County decision came down, and the judge had indicated that the parties were to exchange that property, it was a little bit more cooperative in terms of turning that property over. When I cross-examined Dennis Gert about that property, Dennis testified that he didn't really want it, and he would my client could go and get it. There wasn't a lot left, but he could go get the property, and he'll either deliver it or allow my client to pick it up. And that is exactly what happened after that trial. So the decision.
If you don't mind, just because our time is going fast.
I know.
Yeah. So as I understand it, you're not raising any issues about the personal property in this appeal. Am I
right? No.
Okay. Let's talk about the part that I think I do understand you're challenging. So as I understand it, there is both sides are arguing that as to that settlement agreement that you've already described for us.
Yes.
Parties are arguing that the other party breached first, and that therefore their performance.
Yes. That's the heart of this appeal.
Right. And you don't disagree, I think, on the law, that law applies and to any contract. But in this case, if it's a material breach, the other party's performance may be excused, right?
Yes. Okay. That's the law that we were relying on.
But what our district court found is that it was your client's, Robert's, material breach that happened first, and that it was a material breach and therefore excused the performance of the respondents. And that has to do with removing the encumbrances or the mortgages, lines of credit that were attached to the Section 4 property on which you have this option, Robert has the option to purchase.
That's correct. That's correct.
So the district court made that determination. And when I read your brief, and this was on summary judgment, when I read your brief, I don't see that you challenge the district court's analysis of the undisputed facts that show that Robert, in fact, did not, you know, did breach this. I think it's paragraph 6, right, of the settlement agreement.
I believe that was it. Yes.
So on what grounds would we reverse that summary judgment decision? Send it back. Yeah.
Here's the heart of the matter, because this is what I brought up repeatedly in the district court. The requirement of my client to removing the encumbrances for his farm loans that were secured by the Section 4 land, he was supposed to pay off those loans at the time that he received clear title to the Section 3 land that he was already living on. And that's what that settlement agreement provided. The fact of the matter is the requirement that he clear the encumbrances was the dates go in August, but what really happened is that there was a lawsuit that was brought against Lucille and his father's sister in Grant County too. So we had another lawsuit going on to clear the title to my clients, Dennis and Deborah Gert, or Robert and Deborah Gert.
And counsel, if you don't mind, I did read the district court heard this argument. The district court yep. heard her argument about how it took some time for title to clear
yes.
for Robert for the Section 3 property. And the district
right.
still found, you know, that event, the clear title to Section 3, did happen quite some time ago. I have the exact date in front of me somewhere. And Robert still did not act under the settlement agreement to comply with his promise to clear the encumbrances mm-hmm. of mortgages mm-hmm. from Section 4 property. In fact, as I read it, that issue got tried to the district court. Who is it that cleared the encumbrances? It actually was mostly the respondents and not...
Robert did part of it, and Dennis Gert did
but
the other.
You're acknowledging he breached it.
Yes. Right? Yes.
I am,
but there's another episode and there's another factor in this thing that we didn't learn until we were well into that lawsuit between the Gerts. What happened was in the fall of 2015. Lucille and the rest of the respondents entered into a purchase agreement with a neighbor named Lacey. Lacey wanted to buy the property. He was the first one that back in early 2015, he was the one who made a bid on that property. But what they did was the closing was 30 days. It was sometime in October, and the closing was 30 days, and the 30 days passed. So they had to do something. When I say they, I mean the respondents and Mr. Lacey. So what they did was they wrote up a farm lease, which gave the right to farm that property, which already my client had a right to farm that property, that Section 4 property. But he received a part of that agreement they reached for the land lease was a number of years, and I don't have it's 10, 12, 15 years. I think it was 18 years, as a matter of fact. And he had the right to farm the property my client was supposed to farm for 18 years. And he received an option, a right of first refusal for 100 years that he would have the right to buy the property if anybody else was interested in buying the property.
So this, Mr. Hagstrom, just so I understand where this argument is going, I think you're asserting then that this is a prior breach by respondents.
Yes.
A breach that preceded your client's failure to clear the encumbrances. Was this argument made in the district court? The argument you're
making? A number of times. We made Rule 60 motions, and we included that each time. And I think when we were trying to vacate that Rule 60, summary judgment, we brought that up because we didn't find out about that lease until my client, looking at the district court records in the case of, I think it was the Gertz, the respondents here against Mr. Lacey. There was a litigation there. And in the course of that, they took depositions. And that's when we found out in the district court records that there was this lease, including a copy of the lease that was attached to the affidavits they were using in the litigation in the Grant County case. So we didn't include it in summary judgment responses because we didn't know about it, but we did include it later on when it became obvious to us, because my client was totally his rights under the settlement agreement were totally destroyed by that. In fact, later on, I can't remember when this was, but it was, I think, one of the rulings on summary judgment in the Grant County case. Judge Dahl had to address the issue of whether or not the lease was enforceable. And in fact, she said it was enforceable. So, I mean, with that, it took away all of Mr. and Mrs. Gertz's rights under that settlement agreement. And that's what I'm talking about as being prior breach. In addition, there were a number of other things leading up to the case.
Counsel,
pardon?
If I could just ask one question, and I appreciate it, probably make you go over time. So Judge Harris, that's all right.
That's fine.
Okay. So here's what I'm trying to understand. You did make some arguments about the prior breach, this Lacey lease in district court, but the district court denied your motion to amend the complaint, also denied your Rule 60 motion, and every time after reviewing the history found that you did know of this lease during the pending litigation, the litigation
during,
led up to this appeal.
Yes,
don't,
that's correct.
Don't interrupt me, counsel. Please let me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. And so what the district court said is that you waited too long, you know, until discovery was over before you raised this issue. So how do you respond to that? And maybe you want to do it in your rebuttal. I don't want to force you to.
And why don't we do this, counsel? Given that your time is up, I'm just going to have you consider that question, and then you can respond to it at the beginning of your rebuttal.
That's fine, Your Honor. That's
thank you. Mr. Seeger, you can begin your argument when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Nathan Seeger. I'm an attorney in Fergus Falls, and I represent the respondents, Gert family, collectively. I have submitted a very thorough brief, which I don't mean to go over that in detail because I've already done it in writing. But I would like to simply say this is what opposing counsel is trying to do is to assert facts, grounds, or basis after the summary judgment motion has already been decided. So when you look at the summary judgment motion that was filed in August 31st of 2022, and they filed their responses in October and in early November, I believe, none of those affidavits submitted by either Robert Gert from October 27 of 2017, or Robert Gert and Deborah Gert in October 3rd of 2022 addressed the issue of Robert Gert's breach for failing to remove his lines of credit. The only thing is that Deborah Gert did admit that she went into the bank in the spring of 2021 to check on the balances, and also did admit that she went to the bank with her husband, Robert Gert, and they made a partial payment on the lines of credit. They left interest balances on those lines of credit, which kept the mortgages in force. So in essence, they were admitting that they did not remove the mortgages from the Section 4 land. They did not provide any information to show that there was a genuine issue of material fact that the mortgages existed. With regard to the Lacey lease, they did not assert that at all in the summary judgment, in the response to the summary judgment motion. And most specifically, I think the Lacey lease is a red herring because when you look at the quitclaim deed to Lucille Gehrt from January 26 of 2015, the quitclaim deed specifically says the premises shall be subject to the option of purchase as defined in the settlement agreement, then gives the Otter Tail Court File 56 CV 133218 attached as Exhibit A. That quitclaim deed was of public record at the recorder's office so that everyone had knowledge, and any other person who may have acquired an interest in the Section 4 land would be subject to that option to purchase. Further, not only the quitclaim deed was recorded, but also the settlement agreement was recorded as part of Exhibit A to that quitclaim deed. And paragraph 5 of the settlement agreement further talks about no lien in excess of the amount of $400 shall be valid. So I think that it's a red herring that the Lucille Gehrt had the right to try to make her land productive. And I don't think that the Lacey lease is a breach of the settlement agreement because of the language contained specifically in the settlement agreement as well as in the quitclaim deed. Further, at that time, there was the letter from appellant's attorney at that time, Greg Larson, dated April 30 of 2015, that specifically said that the settlement agreement was not yet effective. And then, of course, there was the litigation filed by appellants Robert Gehrt and Deborah Gehrt with the Otter Tail District Court on July 17 of 2015, seeking to rescind the settlement agreement. So, for those bases, I think that the argument that the Lacey lease argument was never made. No genuine issue of material fact was presented on that, nor does one exist as the issue is a red herring.
So, counsel, the argument you just made about the Lacey lease, the merits of that theory are quite different from what I read the district court's analysis to be. The district court essentially found that whatever happened with the Lacey lease doesn't involve the respondents. The respondents aren't parties to the Lacey lease. So is that, I mean, I question that because Lucille certainly did sign the Lacey lease, but so did the trustee for the family trust. And so I assume that the lease would in fact bind the respondents who are now the current hold title to Section 4. Am I wrong about that?
No, Your Honor, you're right. The district court in the Lacey litigation found that it was binding against us. But my point is this, is with regard to any other person asserting any other type of right. So if Robert Gehrt is saying, I have a pre-existing right that was recorded at the recorder's office in January of 2016, 2015, it would defeat any subsequent unrecorded rental agreement or lease agreement that occurred subsequently.
So it wouldn't effectuate a breach, is I think your argument.
Correct, correct. With regard to the several comments made by the appellants in their reply brief and also in their main brief that respondents Gertz did not respond to the offer to purchase. Remember, Your Honors, there was the April 30th, 2015 letter from appellant's attorney saying that the settlement agreement was not yet effective. There was also the July 17, 2015 district court action in Otter Tail County seeking to rescind it. And then also, most importantly, there was the notice of breach and circumstances served upon the appellants in December of 2019 that set out in detail the court's prior orders, including this Court of Appeals, and also notifying the appellants of their specific breaches. And then also in the appellants June 2023 motions, in two of them, I believe one was June 25th, one was June 26th, they again sought to rescind the settlement agreement. So with that, Your Honors, that concludes my remarks that I have, unless you have further questions of me.
I do not see any further questions. Thank you, counsel. We will reset the clock for the 5 minutes. Mr. Hagstrom, you can begin your rebuttal, and I will just note that your camera is such that we cannot see you, so you're going to have to readjust it, please.
There you go. I'm sorry.
All right, and you can begin your rebuttal when you're ready.
Thank you. It's hard for me to understand how the parties, the respondents here, could enter into a farm lease involving the land that was already agreed to be part of the settlement agreement, not only to, with the option to purchase, but with the right to farm that land. But that farming the land was given away to Mr. Lacey. And the options to buy that my client had were effectively ruined by that lease. Regardless of what was on some, I guess it was a quitclaim deed or something like that. But the fact of the matter is telling my client, or at least advising that there is a lease here or a settlement agreement that has to be taken into consideration, is not the same thing as having in their hands a copy of the lease providing for 18 years of farming and 100 years on the period of time that they had a right to refuse.
So, when is there a particular clause in the settlement agreement that you believe the Lacey, by entering into the Lacey Leach, that the settlement agreement was breached? Or is there perhaps a case in particular that where you can say, well, entering into a lease necessarily breaches an option contract such as the one Robert had?
Yeah, I believe there is. And there's, in fact, two paragraphs in that settlement agreement. I believe they are paragraphs 5 and 9. One of them was mentioned by Mr. Seeger as a limitation on the encumbrances on the property. And the other one is a number of prohibitions as to how the Lucille or the respondents can use the land. For example, and I was trying to find it here because it's in one of our briefs here, the exact language of it. But I can tell you that is the first one is paragraph 5 and the second one is paragraph 9 in the settlement agreement. And not only does it limit the amount of encumbrance that can be placed on the property, but also it also limits the use of that property, specifically with regard to things like CRP and the rest of it. It's quite specific. And I think that entering into a lease with somebody else is entering into a lease with somebody else violates that paragraph. I wish I had. I know it was part of the memorandums that I kept here. Before my time is up, I want to make sure that I make extremely clear that we raised that Lacey Reach Lacey lease Repeatedly. Now, we didn't have that. We didn't discover the lease until after the summary judgment. But when we did get it, that's when we started making Rule 60 motions to vacate that summary judgment. Because clearly,
all right, Mr. Hagstrom, are you still there? All right, so at this point, the court, this case will be submitted. Mr. Hagstrom, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
All right, well, you have 45 seconds here to make any final statements you'd like.
All right, can you hear me now?
Yes, barely.
Okay. There were breaches that are outlined in the original response to the summary judgment motion. They were all there. We did not have a copy of the lease and did not discover the lease until the summary judgment had already been decided upon. And that's where we raised that lease as being a substantial breach of the settlement agreement. And in fact, we use Mr. Seeger's argument with regard to the first party breaching is has no further obligations under the contract. So the whole business about removing the encumbrances at that point in time, we felt that our clients were excused from performing that. They may have an argument, they may have an obligation to the bank, but they didn't have any more obligations under the settlement agreement. That was a very substantial breach, and especially after Judge Dahl said that that it was enforceable. And it
all
goes
right, so,
to the fact.
So, counsel, I do note that I did give you some additional time after your time expired, given the technical difficulties, but now we are well over time. So, we are, I will note that thank you both for your oral argument and your briefing in this matter. It was helpful. This matter is now submitted to the court, and we will issue an order in the statutory time frame. With that, counsel, you are both free to log off, and I thank you both for your time and patience in this matter.
Thank you for your accommodations, Judge. I appreciate that.